Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, books on fish and fishing culture. And with us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Dennis Minsky, biologist and naturalist on the Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch Boats. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
All right, Jill, we're going to start this off with a poem from Mary Oliver.
That is where I'd like to start today, given that she so recently died and she has written many poems, actually, about fish, but this one is called simply The Fish. The first fish I ever caught would not lie down quiet in the pail, but flailed and sucked at the burning amazement of the air and died in the slow pouring off of rainbows. Later, I opened his body and separated the flesh from the bones and ate him. Now the sea is in me. I am the fish. The fish glitters in me. We are risen, tangled together, certain to fall back to the sea. Out of pain and pain and more pain, we feed this feverish plot. We are nourished by the mystery. Mm. That's The Fish by Mary Oliver.
And I think this topic was, Dennis, your idea, right? To do fish and fishing culture? Yeah. So tell us why you wanted to do that. Was it a tough assignment? Not so tough?
The only tough aspect of this assignment is this could be a three-part series. I for those of you at home, I cannot see Jill behind a mountain of books, and I brought my own mountain, and there's a mountain at home I didn't bring.
Yeah.
I think I read 12 books, and this is always such a great education. This could be a three-part series for sure. That's the only difficult aspect.
Yeah. How about you, Jill?
I agree. Yeah. And for me, it was tough in part because I realized how little I know about fishing, how little I know about fish. I enjoy eating fish from time to time, but honestly, I had no idea the breadth and depth of fishing literature. Yeah. There is a pile, and I, too, left a pile, several piles at home and have one pile of books here.
All right, let's get into the pile. Dennis, what's your first book?
Well, my first book is something perhaps a friend of mine, Lori, in New Mexico, recommended to me, New Mexico. And it is a little jewel of a book called Fishing Around Nantucket. It actually came from the Nantucket Library, by the library loan. And it is by J. Clinton Andrews. Many of you will know Edith Andrews, his wife, who was a naturalist there. And he is a third or fourth generation Nantucket fellow. By the picture on the cover, rather aged when he wrote the book, the late 90s, mm-hmm. I believe it came out. And it is just the history of fishing on Nantucket. A lot of this would apply to anywhere on the Cape, but just such wonderful, wonderful stuff. Quahogs were 35 cents a bushel. Mm. Lobsters were, you know, like a quarter a piece. He talks about scallops. So, I mean, we're going back to the turn of the last century.
I was gonna say, it's been a while since we've seen prices like that.
Yeah. He says, scallops have been used for food for such a short time that we can document the fishery quite accurately. Scallop shells are found in far fewer Indian middens than those of other shellfish. An article in the Nantucket Inquirer of 1822 calls them clappers, and they were used for bait. Used for bait. Now they're,
$18.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Crazy.
These are bay scallops, and they're even more. A beautiful piece of history about Nantucket and about the fisheries around Nantucket. I don't know how easy this is to find, but
the library.
Bug your local librarian.
Fishing around Nantucket.
All right. Fishing around Nantucket.
Jill.
Well, I apologize for this ahead of time, but I have to say that the one book that immediately came to mind when I knew we were doing fishing was The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss. And I think part of the reason that this book came to mind was not only that there's a very key fish character in this book, but it was also happened to be the first book I ever learned to read on my own. That wasn't, you know, a school book. So therefore, it has
stuck in your memory.
It has really stuck in my mind. And I have to say, the fish is a great character in this book.
He's the one
and
the reason. Yeah.
You know, by page three, the fish is sitting there quietly in the fish in its little bowl. And by page five, something goes bump and the fish wakes up and looks alarmed. And if it weren't for the fish, you know, everything would have fallen apart in this story. Of course, the cat, as you, many of you probably know, the Cat in the Hat does arrive. But our fish said, no, no, make that cat go away. Tell that Cat in the Hat you do not want to play. He should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out. So the fish is the voice of reason mm-hmm. in this story. And interestingly, for those of you that might watch or listen to Chris Hayes on MSNBC from time to time, he has something he calls Thing One and Thing Two. And I'm here to tell you that Thing One and Thing Two originated in the book, The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss. They show up at the end of the book and make a great deal of mess and confusion. Yeah. But the fish makes sure that everything gets back to normal. And the fish is very upset with the Cat in the Hat. As he says, now look what you did, said the fish to the cat. Now look at this house. Look at this. Look at that. You sank our toy ship, sank it deep in the cake. You shook up our house and you bent our new rake. You should not be here when our mother is not. You get out of this house, said the fish in the pot. And luckily, the fish is listened to, and in fact, the mother arrives and everything goes back to normal, and Thing One and Thing Two leave. But this fish had a very big impact on my childhood, so I had to bring the Cat in the Hat.
All right. Good choice. Dennis?
That's a tough act to follow. Those of you who eat fish should become somewhat acquainted with how it's caught. The second book I'm going to talk about is The Hungry Ocean, A Sword Boat Captain's Journey. It's by Linda Greenlaw, published in 99. Now, she's out of the business now, I think. But if you want to know what it's like, first of all, they go out for 30 days on the Grand Banks. This is out of Gloucester. They take 12,000 pounds of frozen squid for bait, 20,000 gallons of diesel, $3,500 worth of food for a crew of six for the 50 boxes of food. It's really detailed. The conditions out there, quote, the moisture from several days of working in a cold ocean rain seeps through every pore of the skin, chilling to the deepest part of bone. Like an old wooden boat saturated with salt water, it takes a body time to dry out. It would be hours before the last shiver left the spines of the men. And within an hour, all eyes and mouths were ringed with white, crusty, salty deposits left behind by the wind-driven mist. She talks about a crewman pulling out his own tooth because you don't go back for any medical reason. She says any man, anyone. By the way, she strongly objects to being called a fisherwoman. Mm-hmm. No way. Anyone who chooses to make fishing his occupation solely for the money is in the wrong business. Yeah. And that really becomes clear. These people are dedicated to what they're doing. It's an amazing book. By the way, the average crewman on that trip made $5,500 for a month. Really hard work.
Hard work, yeah.
So it's an eye-opening book.
She's great, by the way. I met her at the New Bedford Working Waterfront Festival.
Yeah.
She's an amazing person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Jill.
All right. Now to something a little more serious than The Cat in the Hat, which is a novel that was the answer to a reference question many years ago. People kept coming in asking for this novel that had a fish in it, and one of the characters was a fish. And eventually, I discovered what in fact this novel was. It's called The Shining Tides, and it is a novel that's written by Wynn Brooks. I believe, as far as I can tell, this is the only novel he ever wrote. And I tried to find more information about the book, and here's what the Fireside Book of Fishing said about Wynn Brooks and his book. And by the way, the Fireside Book of Fishing is sort of a great collection of stories as well. They write, what Haig, Brown, and Williamson did for the salmons, Atlantic and Pacific, Wynn Brooks has done for one of the great game fish of salt water, the striped bass. The Shining Tides can be compared with no other modern book on saltwater fishing, for it can best be described as a novel with angling undertones, or perhaps an angling book with novel undertones. Brooks is not only a fine writer, he's an experienced angler and something of an amateur marine biologist. And in fact, it got reviewed when it came out. It got reviewed in the New York Times. And they wrote, with a cast of characters drawn not far above the Plimsoll line of popular fiction, Wynne Brooks has told a heartwarming and constantly interesting story of a group of people who live on or visit seasonally Cape Cod. Using a somewhat intricate construction, the author has put together a mosaic of episodes separated in the text with appropriate vignettes printed in an attractive blue, which add up to a novel redolent with the salt spray of the Atlantic, the smell of marsh grass, and the peculiar quality of sea, sky, dune, and shrub, which constitute the Cape Cod landscape. Cleverly interwoven with several plots is the story of the great striped bass, Raucus. He weighs at least 100 pounds, and his struggles with killer whales, dolphins, and great lobsters, as well as with his human stalkers, form a saga as moving and as intense as that of the Sailor, the Salmon, delineated some years ago by Henry Williamson. Those who know the Cape, especially who have known the thrill of striped bass fishing, will relive their own experiences, feel the tug on their lines, and enjoy the thrill of the play. And one of the things that he does in this book is the fish is one of the narrators. So you get a lot of perspective from the fish's point of view. Here's just a little bit from Rokas's point of view. It's broken up into many sections, but Rokas gets his own section. Rokas's jaw healed swiftly, causing her no pain. As June waned, she joined first one and then another of the many schools of striped bass which remained in the area of Cape Cod Canal. Some of these fish were from the Chesapeake region, and more were native to the Hudson and its tributaries. There were few from the Roanoke. Most of the migrating Roanoke fish had come no farther north than the Jersey coast. All these fish in the canal area moved back and forth with the tides through the big ditch, driving whiting from the bottom to the surface, where in the rips they skidded furiously, heads out of water, terrorized. The bass rose beneath them in pursuit, tail smashing to stun them. Anyway, it goes on, and it's, you know, there's also this plot and a story, but it's really about the fish fishing, and it is called The Shining Tides by Wynne Brooks.
All right.
Also available in your public library nowhere else.
And again, we'll have a link to all the books we talk about today later on our website. Dennis, what's your next book?
Probably the most important book I read in this stack of books is called Four Fish by Paul Greenberg. Very well written, very personal. The four fish are salmon, tuna, cod, and bass. Not striped bass, but sea bass. He says, those who study fish or pursue fish or live among fishermen love fish dearly. Meanwhile, the rest of the world eats more and more of them without ever bothering to learn about them. I hope that dynamic might change, that fish might be understood as their own kind of perfection, meriting their own special kind of respect. This entire book is, should fish be seen as expendable seafood or wildlife desperately in need of our compassion? The fact of the matter is, that even though fish is a fraction of meat in terms of our diet and world diets, less more so American, we are vacuuming the sea, sometimes quite literally. That's another book. But he said if everybody wanted to eat wild salmon, we would need four or five oceans to supply them. So I'm not going to quote a lot from this book, but the solution to this dilemma will have to be some combination of reasonable fishing for wild fish and very smart farming of fish. And as you may know or not know, there are quite a few problems, especially with salmon. I hate to say it because so many people love salmon, including me, but farmed salmon has a lot of problems. PCBs and so on and so forth. I won't go into that. But there are some groundbreaking or water-breaking advances in farming aquaculture that will need to be pursued because he says the future of human growth depends largely on how we manage our oceans. We need our fish. and we need to do a lot better job in harvesting and farming them. Very, very important book.
All right, what's the name again?
Four Fish.
Okay. Four Fish. Okay.
Four Fish.
All right. We are talking about books on fish and fishing culture, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on fish and fishing culture. With us today, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, biologist and naturalist on the Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch boats. Jill, what is your next book?
My next book is it's actually a novella is what it is, and a couple of other stories that go with it. And it's a book a lot of people know about because they've seen the movie. It's why I knew about this book, but I'd never read it. It's called A River Runs Through It and Other Stories by Norman MacLean. It also, this particular edition, which is the 25th anniversary edition, has a foreword by Annie Prue. It is really a beautiful story, and it is about way more than fishing, of course. And in fact, I was surprised, it is almost as much about drinking as it is about fishing, which apparently the two, from what I gather and what I've read, often go together, which I did not know prior to doing some research for this show. And I also did not know this story, that when it was originally written, was based on something that actually had happened to the author. In the foreword, Annie writes, Norman Fitzroy MacLean was born in Iowa on December 23, 1902, into a Scots Presbyterian family with Nova Scotia roots. His brother Paul, born 3 years later, was murdered in 1938, the cruel event around which the title story twists. And the father, John Norman MacLean, was a minister. And of course, in the story, the father is indeed a minister. It is really memoir as story. And the opening paragraph is just beautiful. The writing is extraordinarily beautiful, even all the parts about people getting drunk. It's all good. It begins, in our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing, which I think is a great opening line for this. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John the Favorite was a dry fly fisherman. One also learns lots about flies during and how to tie a fly and what kind of flies are better than other kind of flies. But there's also some beautiful passages. Here's one between the father and the son who does not die. You are too young to help anybody, and I am too old, he said. By help, I don't mean a courtesy like serving choke cherry jelly or giving money. Help, he said, is giving part of yourself to somebody who comes to accept it willingly and needs it badly. So it is, he said, using an old homiletic transition, that we can seldom help anybody. Either we don't know what part to give, or maybe we don't like to give any part of ourselves. Then, more often than not, the part that is needed is not wanted. And even more often, we do not have the part that is needed. It is like the auto supply shop over town, where they always say, sorry, we are just out of that part. I told him, you make it too tough. Help doesn't have to be anything that big. He asked me, do you think your mother helps him by buttering his rolls? She might, I told him. In fact, yes, I think she does. Do you think you help him? He asked me. I try to, I said. My trouble is, I don't know him. In fact, one of my troubles is that I don't even know whether he needs help. I don't know. That's my trouble. And it has this really beautiful, after many terrible things happen in the course of this, and there are endless fishing scenes, all beautifully written. The end of the piece is also just incredibly beautiful. And there is this sort of meditation about fishing, but also about how to, that piece about how to help people. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman. And now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then, in the arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories and the sounds of the big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters. It's beautiful. Just beautifully written, and it is a heartbreaking story, but really beautifully written. And it is called A River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean.
Speaking of fly fishing in Montana, I have to mention Henry Winkler's book. Now, of course,
Henry Winkler is a fisherman.
He's a very passionate fisherman, fly fishing, trout. His book is I've Never Met an Idiot on the River, Reflections on Family, Photography, and Fly Fishing. And he, in the book, talks about just the beauty of the patterns of the trout. And he does the catch and release. He does catch and release. But he is so, competitive might be the word. His wife also fly fishes with him in separate boats, mind you, because he doesn't want her to catch the fish on his side of the boat. Right?
Well, and in the river runs through it, they're always fishing from different sides of the river.
It's got to be your own spot. This is my spot. But yeah, so I remember it being a really, I don't have the book in front of me, but it was a fun read, and of course there's that Henry Winkler humor in there as well. Dennis, what's your next book?
Well, I just have to respond to that. Catch and release. The latest thing is fillet and release. So that's a different thing. That's a joke. Fillet and release. Also, in response to drinking goes with every human activity, and fishing is no exception. However, Linda Greenlaw makes very clear, commercial fishing, There's no alcohol in the boat at all. Recreational fishing.
You know, I had a neighbor when I lived in Vermont who he was going bear hunting with, like, you know, I said, Dick, you're going to shoot a bear? He goes, Mindy, we're 15 guys in the woods drinking beer. There's no bear anywhere near us.
Yeah. Excuse to drink outdoors. Right. My next book is a classic, and I know Jill brought it too. It's The Run by John Hay. John Hay, this was written in 1959, so 60 years ago. He was the premier naturalist on Cape Cod in the 20th century. Large influence on Robert Finch and on me, for that matter. I met him. And The Run, specifically, is the, what they call, herring run. They're actually alewives in Stony Brook, the Stony Brook in Brewster. So many listeners may be familiar with that. So all the books we're talking about really are interactions of people with fish. So this herring run is a classic place where these alewives come in every year. He says that the alewife migrates from sea to ponds through the inland vein, from crabs and shellfish to robins and frogs beyond the tide. So it's beautiful to think of these fish living in two different ecosystems, salt and fresh. It's just beautiful. It just goes into, he says, in barer, colder, perhaps simpler days when men lived closer to their natural surroundings and were more dependent on them than they think they are now, the alewives meant food and revenue and abundance returning to your own backyard. And it was true. They were a big part of the economy. Now they're sort of a neat thing to go look at. And if you've never seen it, it is one of the marvels of biology.
And another one of his big fans was Annie Dillard. And in his obit, he actually died in 2011. And she's quoted in that saying, John Hay is one of the world's handful of very great nature writers.
Yeah.
I love his books with all my heart.
Yeah. So he says about, and this is what I think, and Philip and I talk about this a lot, if you focus on one living thing, he says, I think one of the greatest challenges is to watch each bounded living thing with care for its particularity. No matter how many times I try to describe the alewife by the uses of human speech or classify its habits, its intrinsic perfection resists me. It is something else. It goes on defying my own inquiring sense of mystery. And the whole book ends with two kids out on the Brewster Flats thrashing about, oblivious to the great migration a few yards away. So we live side by side with this natural phenomenon. It's a wonderful book.
Jill.
Well, I had to bring this book that I have in my hands here because it seems like almost every book that I looked at mentioned this book. I have not read this whole book by any means, but it is, as I say, a classic of fishing. It's The Complete Angler or The Contemplative Man's Recreation by Isaac Walton and Charles Cotton. It is still in print. It was published in 1653 and still in print, which in and of itself is totally and completely astonishing. It is a treatise on fishing by Isaac Walton. It takes the form of a dialogue in which Piscator, who's an angler, tries to convince Venator, a hunter, that fishing is the superior sport. The superior sport. And there is, it's been popular since the day it came out, as far as I can tell. And in the intro to this edition of the book, they write, the real reason for the book's popularity lies elsewhere, not in fishing per se, but endures because it is not about how to fish, but about how to be. I will amend that slightly to say that The Complete Angler is about how to dream, and that is why we love it. You see, the search for fish is really a search for a grail, the place of perfect companionship and flawless contentment. Walton promises that if we follow the gallant fisher's life, we will be free of the torments invented by money-getting men. We will savor the peace once tasted by such men as lived in those times when there were fewer lawyers. Again, he's writing this in 1653.
Wow.
And this is sort of the signature passage of the whole book. No life, my honest scholar, no life so happy and so pleasant as the life of a well-governed angler. For when the lawyer is swallowed up with business and the statesman is preventing or contriving plots, then we sit on cowslip banks, hear the birds sing, and possess ourselves in as much quietness as these silent silver streams, which we now see glide so quietly by us. Indeed, my good scholar, we may say of angling, as Dr. Butler said, of strawberries, doubtless God could have made a better berry, but doubtless God never did. And so, if I might judge, God never did make a more calm, quiet, innocent recreation than angling. That is from The Complete
Great.
Angler
Great.
By Isaac Walton.
Dennis.
Yeah, that was on my list too, but I didn't get to it. Another very important book. I was recommended to me by my friend Jeanette. This is people come from all over with ideas. It's called The Most Important Fish in the Sea by Bruce Franklin, written in 2007. I learned so much from this book. The most important fish in the sea, not cod, not salmon, it is menhaden. And they have been caught for centuries, and you don't eat them. No one eats them. They're oily, bony, but they are used for industrial purposes. Over the years, what was shocking to me is in 18 that menhaden oil outstripped whale oil back in the 1870s. In 1880, menhaden oil surpassed whale oil. There were 456 ships fishing for menhaden, 171 ships whaling. At any rate, cut to the current times. There's one company that monopolizes this fishery. It's called Omega Protein out of Houston, It's all used for, well, one thing, you may consume menhaden maybe if you feed your cats, but for fish oil. Everybody takes fish oil. It's supposed to be good for you, the omega-3s. Menhaden, big component of that. And they are vacuuming the sea. Now, the one thing about menhaden that makes it unique, it is a planktivore and a phytoplanktivore. So it only eats algae, green plants in the ocean. And by removing the menhaden from our oceans, which we have done, the Atlantic Ocean almost gone. They're now fishing mainly in the Gulf. They've not been seen north of Cape Cod since like 1980 or something like that. But we are, the Chesapeake Bay has been just really ruined by the removal of these fish, which has affected the blue crab fishery and everything else. So an amazing industrial fishing. They use the omega protein has 61 ships and 32 spotter planes. These planes go up. They find a school of menhaden. The ships come out. They don't leave a one. And these are foundational fish for everything else in the ocean. You eat menhaden if you eat fish, because the fish we eat menhaden. And as I said, they're very important for the keeping the phytoplankton at a reasonable level. So who knew?
Yeah,
there's
right.
Terrific education here.
And what's the name of that book again?
The Most Important Fish in the Sea, Bruce Franklin, 2007. So it's pretty current.
Right. We are talking about books on fish and fishing culture, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about books on fish and fishing culture with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, biologist and naturalist on the Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch. Jill, what is your next book?
Well, my next book I had to bring for Dennis. And much to my amazement, we were talking before the show, Dennis apparently had not heard of this book previously, so I'm delighted to be introducing him to it. It's called My Moby Dick by William Humphrey. And as anyone who's been listening to us talk about books over the years knows that Dennis loves Moby Dick.
And so does Jill.
And in fact, this book begins, Call Me Bill. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, I thought I would go fishing. It is a way I have of driving away the spleen. And after a winter spent in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts, I had a whale of a swollen spleen. Whenever this happens, whenever I find myself snarling at little children, whenever I stop being grateful that my bottle is half full and start grumbling that it is half empty, whenever I get to thinking of committing myself to a mental institution like the handy one there in Stockbridge, then I can account it high time to go fishing as soon as I can, as soon as the season opens, if it ever does. The poet who wrote, "If winter comes, can spring be far behind," had never spent a winter waiting for spring to come in the Berkshires. And what is interesting to me, I had never heard of William Humphrey before, but in fact, as I was looking into this, there was a big article written in the Washington Post in 2009 by Jonathan Yardley, who it turns out is a huge fan of William Humphrey. And as he begins his article, odds are you've never heard of William Humphrey, much less read one of his several books, an unhappy reminder that even the best of writers, and from the publication of his first book in 1953 until his death in 1997, Humphrey was indeed one of the best, have a terribly hard time finding the reader they deserve. Humphrey was blessed with loyal editors and publishers, and for the most part, his books were favorably reviewed. Yet in the last years of his life, it became apparent that neglect was to be his fate, a sad judgment that remains true a dozen years later. And two of the books he's best known for is The Spawning Run, which came out in 1970, and My Moby Dick, which came out in 1978. And as this fellow says, they really are longish essays disguised as books, padded out with large type and lovely illustrations, both having fewer than 100 pages, all of which merely goes to show that small is, or can be, beautiful. So I really think it's a really interesting title, and he writes the reviewer of this says, it isn't an epic quest for a great white whale on the roaring seas, but a sneak attack on a massive trout lazing in a roadside puddle. But Humphrey makes a minor epic of it as he devises his strategies for luring the trout to bite. And it seems that much of fishing isn't, this is another thing I have learned while looking at these books, is waiting for the fish to bite.
Right.
Which may be why, you know, they're also drinking because they get bored. I don't know, but there's a lot of waiting that needs to be done.
Right.
So very meditative activity.
I can say that for a brief time I did some trout fishing up in Nova Scotia, which is more like hunting. Because you're not standing in one place, but you're going along a stream or a river, looking for those pools,
little pockets,
and then going to the next one. So less time for drinking.
What's your next book, Dennis?
I'm going to skip ahead because I'm afraid I'll run out of time. And I have a book that's very difficult to talk about. It's called American Seafood: Heritage, Culture, and Cookery from Sea to Shining Sea. The author is Barton Seaver, relatively recent. But if you have even the slightest interest in fish, this is a beautiful coffee table sort of book.
Yeah, beautiful photos.
Beautiful illustrations. And he says, and I'm not set up here today, but he says, what you hold in your hands is not a cookbook. It's not an Audubon-type guide. It's not an unbiased reference book. It's not specifically a history book, yet it's all of these things at once. It is the story of American seafood, the product, the people, and places. Just as we claim grandma's recipes as part of our heritage, as we claim colorful tomatoes as treasured heirlooms, so too should we see seafood as providing for us the same fundamental values, both civic and emotional. And the pictures, which the audience cannot see.
But they're spectacular.
Are spectacular. And then after a sort of general discussion of some really interesting themes about how fish are second place to meat in our diets and why, then he goes through every species. But one thing, he quotes M.F.K. Fisher, who's a big food writer, wonderful writer. I think she wrote How to Cook a Wolf or something, or How to Eat a Wolf. M.F.K. Fisher, famed American food writer, in her enigmatic but always romantic way, wrote, it is perhaps impossible to say what fresh smells like, except that it smells right, not dubious. It smells like new-cut grass, new-mown hay, an innocent brook, or a child emerging from his bath. Or almost any happy, clean thing, for that matter. So I thought that was great.
Yeah, that
saying,
is great.
That fish fresh? And he makes a point that the way fishing is done now, a frozen fish might be fresher than a fresher fish,
right.
A fresh fish, because they're flash frozen right away. Yeah. I don't know. But every single fish species you could think about is in here, halibut, mussels, you know, crabs, lobster, and with some really, really interesting history on how they're caught, how they're prepared, and what part they played in our history. It's just a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book.
And I have to confess that I had that book in my pile, but it was so heavy.
Only
I
problem,
decided
it's too
not
heavy.
It to bring heavy. It with
it's
me.
It's a coffee table book.
Yeah. I'm
but
impressed
be sure
you
have
it.
A strong table.
All right, chill.
All right. Another thing I learned in doing this fish show is that Robert Hughes, who I think of as, or thought of before seeing this book, as somebody who wrote a history of his homeland, Austria, The Fatal Shore, which was a big book, and as an art critic. And he was the one that put together The Shock of the News, that 8-part documentary about modern art that was showed many years ago at PBS.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's an art historian. Well, it turns out he also fishes. And as a result, he wrote a book called, and it's a great title, title, A Jerk on One End, Reflections of a Mediocre Fisherman. And the title, here's a little bit about the title. A jerk, and this is from the very beginning of the book, a jerk on one end of a line waiting for a jerk on the other. Such is one of the classic folk definitions of fishing. It echoes Samuel Johnson's description of the sport as a stick and a string with a worm on one end and a fool on the other. And who can doubt its truth? In some ways, it's a ridiculous human passion. So he has a certain take on fishing, and but he also does a lot of history. Being, again, an art historian, I think, he goes back to the ancient Romans fishing, and he has a whole section about that. In the ancient world and the early Christian era, practically no one seems to have fished for pleasure. The ancient Romans were big fish eaters, and the more extravagant among them laid out huge sums on private fish ponds. However, the only ancient Roman, certainly the only powerful one, known to have fished for sport was Mark Antony, who, according to Plutarch, went angling in the harbor of Alexandria with Cleopatra and cheated at it. He paid some local fishermen in advance to dive under their barge and snag live fish on his hook so as to cut a bella figura in front of his temptress. Cleopatra, once she caught on, paid him back by having her own slave sneak down into the water and impale a salted fish on Antony's hook, much to the glee of the courtiers. And this pretense of fishing, to judge from Plutarch's account, was part of a pattern of social transvestism the two lovers enjoyed. They would also go slumming incognito late at night, getting into scrapes with the lower classes. Oh, so wow. You not only get fishing in here, you get the ancient Romans as well. He actually died in 2012, Robert Hughes, and as the New York Times wrote, the kind of writer who almost always seemed happier aboard a motorcycle or a fishing boat than a desk. And this is a really beautiful essay, really, on fishing. As the review in Kirkus Review said, an unlikely match of subject, author, and series puts art critic and historian Hughes at the other end of a fishing pole. Hughes brings the same mixture of insight, self-deprecating whimsy, and caustic wit to the subject of angling that he has put to good use in art criticism and polemics. Mm-hmm. And he, in fact, grew up in Australia, and it talks about a lot about Australian fishing as well. It's called A Jerk on One End, Reflections of Mediocre Fisherman by Robert Hughes. Mm.
All right, lovely. Dennis.
I just want to, it reminded me, one book I'm not going to talk about, The Old Man of the Sea. I thought of it immediately. I was a big Hemingway fan. I still like some of his writing. Might have been his worst book. You maybe get some angry calls from readers, but a very mediocre book. Used the word mediocre.
I just have to ask you, did you bring Cod by Mark Kurlansky?
I did not bring it.
Yes, I did not either.
Because
and
it's so well
known. Yes.
I have to think that most people know about that book.
Mm-hmm. I felt the same way. But...
in fact, for
I felt we should mention it.
What's his name? In Four Fish, he actually interviews Mark Kurlansky. They go to lunch and he is so... Yeah, that is a foundational book, Cod. Yeah. A book that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is the Provincetown Seafood Cookbook and by Howard Mitchum, who was quite a character in Provincetown in the old days. And he was in Provincetown and in New Orleans, so...
Have we mentioned that book before,
We did
Jill?
Mention, and I'm trying, I can't remember which show it was cookbooks. And how it connected, yeah. But well, it also has just recently been republished with the new intro by Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah. Yes, of late, yeah.
And that is a very worn copy that you have there.
My wife forbade me to bring it even, because it's falling apart. But I just want to show, most people have this book, it looks like this, because, and I cooked squid stew at my men's club a couple of years ago. Using Howard Mitchum for 40 people. But it is such a hilarious book. Jackson Lambert, I knew Howard Mitchum, and Jackson Lambert, another wonderful character in Provincetown, great artist, illustrated it. But Howard Mitchum gives a history of Provincetown. From the earliest times, cod, haddock, and mackerel have been the top fish of Provincetown. Provincetown's beaches were once lined with fish drying platforms called flakes. The curing fish had to be put out each morning at sunrise and taken in at sunset. It was a grueling chore in which even the women and children had to participate. So the whole town was just covered with these drying fish. It was before tourism, let's mm-hmm. say. And then he gets into the whole Portuguese phenomenon and how wonderful they were. No two Portuguese are just alike. Each is a character on his own hook, a universe unto himself, which is why they are so damned interesting. I mean, it's really a lot of fun, this book, great. And very useful as a cookbook.
Okay. Jill.
Well, I felt we had to. This is another one I felt we had to talk about, and I believe Dennis has a copy as well. And this happens so rarely that when we do this show, that we bring the same books. But in this case, this book is called Blues by John Hersey, and just even from the acknowledgments, you will see why we had to talk about this book a little bit. He acknowledges, the fisherman's acquaintance with the bluefish has been much enhanced over the years by trips in spray to Woods Hole, with its many riches, the Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and the Woods Hole Laboratory of the Northeast Fisheries Center of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It is very much a book of Cape Cod and the vineyard, and it has all kinds of mentions. It is, in fact, it's a sort of odd book in that it is a discussion between these two characters, for the fisherman and the stranger, and they are having a discussion much similar to what happens in The Complete Angler, and they're talking about fish, and it not only has this story of them fishing and all the things you need to fish, but there also are recipes in this book. It could be just a poetry anthology of mm-hmm. for fishing poems, because mm-hmm. almost every chapter ends with a poem. So if you want a good group of fishing poetry, this is a great book to pick up. And it is basically a prose dialogue between a fisherman and a stranger conducted one summer on the waters of Vineyard Sound off Martha's Vineyard. Blues is about fishing for bluefish, those ravenous, chopping predators of the sea whose young are called snappers. And as it says in the New York Times review, Blues is both argument and anthology. The fisherman sees a shorebound stranger looking wanly at the sea and offers to take him fishing. The stranger consents but admits, quote, "I'm afraid I have a scruple. I hate the idea of slaughtering fish mm-hmm. for sport." Slowly, the stranger is led into the mind of the fisherman who angles only for his supper, and into the complex beauties of the ocean and its inhabitants. The season's days follow a familiar pattern. Each outing, the two new friends fish with different techniques and over different ground, the fisherman regaling the stranger with his scientific and piscatory knowledge, then bluefish for supper, each night a new recipe, and finally a poem for contemplation's purpose. The recipes are excellent, and the poems about fish and the metaphysics of fishing are by John Chardy, James Merrill, Robert Penn Warren, Elizabeth Bishop, and others. It's a great collection of poetry, as well as at the end, there are lots of recipes and just a beautiful book about fishing. Would you like to add to that, Dennis?
No. I found the sort of back and forth a little bit stilted, but once you get over that, it's a little bit artificial, the language, but it's a lot of, as you say, great, great recipes too.
Yeah.
It's called Blues by John Hersey.
All right. And we are going to have to end it there. I know we didn't get to all of the books, and that happens from time to time, but we will have a link to the list of all the books we talked about today at our website, capeandislands.org. Be up there a little bit later today once Jill puts it together. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Dennis Minsky, biologist and naturalist at the Dolphin Fleet Whale Watch. Thank you both.
Thank you,
Thank
Mindy.
You.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.